Friday morning, and that means it's another edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. Jeremy, my son and partner, is here with me, and we are welcoming another guest, another author, this time a very good friend, Tom Galvin, and there he is, right there. Tom, in addition to being a very close friend and a good colleague, spent many years as a political reporter. New York Post, New York Daily News, that's how we got to know each other, and then went from there to become a communications specialist, a troubleshooter, and great consultant on behalf of some of the iconic tech giants in the United States. I mean, we're talking Cisco, Sun Systems, Qualcomm, a whole lot of folks, and now Tom is an author. An author of fiction, and the book is The Auction, as you can see right now on the screen. Welcome, Tom. Good to see you again.
Jeremy and John, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's our pleasure, and we thank you again. So I'm just going to set the stage. This is a dystopian future that we're looking at in this novel. And staggering thing is, the year is 2050. Stop and think. That's 29 years from now. United States has a caste system, and 22-year-olds are put up for auction to determine their future. Leading corporations are investing in what is essentially a human futures market. Tom, tell us about this auction. How does it work? And what does it mean for 22-year-olds and then for the nation in 2050?
Sure. When I was writing The Auction, I wanted to create a world that didn't feel necessarily too distinct from where we are today. Lives may on the surface seem very similar. But the United States went through an economic crisis that almost led to the collapse of the country. And ultimately, the solution was to create capitalism and create it at a much higher and an intense level than it is today. So there's seven large companies that effectively run the country, both economically and politically. They're our de facto government. And when someone turns 22, they get analyzed and bid on by those companies who get a stake in their future. So it's a world where everything, including people, are now commodities. And John, you've always talked a lot about we're really at the forefront of digital immigrants and digital natives, and now these are digital assets. So everyone is an asset, and your future is determined at 22 based on how valuable you are. If you're extremely valuable, what we call a Series A, think of you like an NFL number one pick or a rock star, well, you're going to have handlers who are going to protect you against anything, regardless of what you do. And if you're at the lower tier of the caste that you talk about, Series D, well, your life isn't worth a lot because you don't have a lot of financial value to the big seven companies that run this. And that leads to really bad outcomes for you, sometimes even tragic. So it's built on a system that, like I said, doesn't feel very different than today, but in many respects is commentary on how the algorithm and technology and putting a value on everything, and only financial values mattering, is where we're heading. And the other half of it is putting enormous pressure on 22-year-olds that their future is dictated at that age, when really that shouldn't be what's happening. They should be having a moment to be able to live their lives. But it's really meant to demonstrate how it gets warped, because if you're valuable, it actually matters to your parents. So the way they act also changes towards you.
So this is a novel. And what's always compelling about novels are the stories that you weave. And you have main characters who are kind of realistic composites of real people. And you get into very deeply the social, personal, the psychological, the cultural implications of the auction and surveillance and control, you know, by these large corporations that rule America. Tell us a little bit about your character development and who you included and why you included some of the people that you did.
The story is built around four characters who are of that age. And the first is Sasha Cross. And Sasha Cross is really the daughter of Hollywood royalty. And we're seeing the transference not only of wealth, but of celebrity, which we see today. And she really wants no part in it. Her mom was the most famous woman in the world. And almost by default, people became fascinated with her. But she kind of rejects that world and is just trying to live her own life. But unfortunately, through coercion from her father, she's put in a position where she, who's really struggling with the auction and everything about it, she's very uncomfortable with it, but she gets put in a situation where she effectively becomes the face of it. And that is fundamentally the story of her grappling between these two different poles. One, which is a system that works really well for people like her. And in many respects, she's hated by the lower series because they see her as the epitome of it, but her actually feeling more affection for them or understanding of them. So the story really tries to tell a story of her trying to find her voice along the way. One of her best friends is a man named Jason who lost his parents in a car accident in which he was in the car, and there are secrets behind that. And he is desperately trying to redeem his family as an e-gamer. But at each step of the way, he's thwarted, including by an old friend, sketchy old friend, who is really almost blackmailing him to go along with illegal schemes, because Jason needs to get to 22 and his auction, because if he does, his aunt who raised him will make a lot of money from it. Because in the auction, the money that you get bid on, say millions of dollars, that goes to your parents or your guardians in this case, because there's no Social Security. So everything is privatized. So it tells a story of Jason as he tries to grapple and save his family while trying to hide secrets. Another character, Avery, is a very entitled 22-year-old person of privilege, always overshadowed by his brother. He's very ruthless and uses him in a way to kind of spy on other auction candidates. And Avery's trying to find his own way. He starts to see the other side. But in the end, it's interesting because through his own way, he becomes just as ruthless as his brother. And the final one, who's just a couple years older, is a man named Vincente, who was a Series D at the lower rung. And his life is somewhat bleak. And when he stumbles upon information while working at a secret military installation, it really threatens his life. So it's really trying to tell the story from lots of different perspectives, whether it's your status or your socioeconomic background.
What I really appreciated about, and I love this book, Tom, I really did, and congratulations. And I really urge everybody out there to well, first of all, buy it, pay some money for it, and then feel free to read it. But you really should. What I really appreciated is that in many ways it's a similar message to 1984, but you have accomplished a writing of such a story in not the dark and dank black and white method that 1984 was written. This is actually an engaging novel. These are real stories that we can relate to. Was this the plan on your part to write something fairly in a fairly light-ish style?
It was, and it was really designed. There's a lot of great stories. You know, there's Mad Max and everything. You know, you can see where the world turned. This was supposed to be more the incremental changes that occur that get you to a place that is pretty scary. So that's why I wanted a world that seems similar to where we are today. But when you start to scratch the surface, you realize where we've come to, where everyone's a commodity and your 22-year-old son or daughter is essentially your ticket to retirement. And all you care about is whether or not they do things that are financially beneficial to you. So you don't really want them to be a teacher or a policeman or a firefighter, all these really noble professions, because they don't pay money. And so when everyone gets treated as an asset, when our children are literally an asset, and one of the things that really drove this was, we used to say a lot, we're mortgaging our children's future. You know, that was when it came to like the deficit and everything else. This was literally meant to be mortgaging our children's future for our own sake. But I wanted to do it in a world that felt familiar, because to me, that seems more alarming.
And it is indeed. So let's talk about how alarming. Again, this is 29 years into the future. And you write about extensive, pervasive surveillance. You include in there the pervasive use of big data. deep fakes. Let's say we're on a scale of 1 to 10, and we're talking 2050 and 2021. 10, a score of 10, means we are very close to the dystopia that you write about, 2050. One is, it's just not going to happen. Where are we today on that scale?
Where we are today is probably a 2 or 3. Where I personally worry we will be by the time we get there is a 7 or 8. Because what you talk about is there's a database where every public thought you have, every record, every piece of healthcare, any possible information is scraped and put into a database that essentially determines your future and allows people to predict your actions. So that might seem fantastical, but if you look at social credit scores, like things that are happening in China, which if you're not considered a good bet or you're considered disloyal, your children don't get into the good schools. It's already happening on that level where people are using information. Data is now being used to determine our healthcare, our life insurance, our applicability for jobs. So we're already starting to head down that road. So I think that is, we're already seeing that. What this was supposed to do, to steal an old line from Spinal Tap, was bring it to 11 and demonstrate how the world would change if we keep going in this route.
So I want those of you who are listening or those of you who are going to be reading the transcript of this to know just who we're talking to today. I mentioned at the very beginning that you were a troubleshooter, a communications expert, a strategic planner and communicator for the tech giants, a who's who. You have their ear. You've had their ear over the years. How do we undo this track that we may very well be on? You've got their ear right now. What are some of the things that you warn them about?
So I went into the technology world in 1998 when I moved out to Silicon Valley to work with technology companies. And at the time, it was in the early days of the internet and very idealistic about what it could mean and how it could bridge the digital divide and equalize people through access. What we've seen over time, unfortunately, is that an engineering mentality has pervaded. There wasn't a lot of sociologists and psychologists back then. It was not should we do this, but can we do this? So over time, we've now reached a point where we've moved further along. The surveillance has become more sophisticated, and we're making decisions about whether that we can, not whether we should. And that's fundamentally what I would get to. How do we avoid this becoming a reality? I think it has to be fundamentally society deciding what they want from this. I use a parable a lot about the frog in the boiling water. There's a parable that if you put a frog in boiling water, it'll immediately jump out because the water's too hot. But if you started in tepid water and gradually raise the temperature, it's going to have a bad outcome for the frog without them ever realizing it. I would propose that that's society today. We have to make our own decisions. We're not just a twig floating down a river. We're people who can decide what our future is. And it's up to us to decide that. And that includes working with technology companies and everything else to make sure that the world that we want in 2050 is the one that works best for us and not just for large corporations or technology.
What's the role of the public in all of this? The technological genie is out of the bottle, and the capacity on the part of tech giants and leadership to go off into this dystopian direction is very real. What role does the general public just sit by and watch, or is there a role beyond the leadership of Silicon Valley?
Yeah, I wouldn't rely on Silicon Valley exclusively as any more than I would rely on policymakers. I think we're all in the mix of this. We all have to have a say in what the future looks like. So to me, I think the public can talk about these things and it can raise issues. It can elect leaders who want to do it, who want to try to make sure that we live in a responsible world that respects people's value and not just their financial value. So I think there's a lot of things that the public can do and will do. I think it comes down to Silicon Valley to make sure that they are offering solutions that are actually beneficial. Technologies, and by the way, technology is not evil. Technology is amoral. And all that means is it's not good or bad. It's how it's applied. The first hammer could help build a house for a family to keep them safe from the storm. It could also brain your neighbor. It's not really about the technology. It's how the technology is used. And we all play a role in that.
So obviously, this debate is ongoing. The current heated debate is over Facebook and whether or not Facebook has the right people, the right mechanisms in it to, you know, to prevent some of the worst abuses, you know, that we've seen. Are these tech giants cognizant of their social negative social implications? Are they creating an infrastructure to be preventative, or do you think we still have too long a way to go for that recognition?
We definitely have a long way to go, but it really comes down to, for lack of a better term, the business model. In the auction, these seven large companies have a vested interest in making money off these people. So at the highest level, Series A's, superstars, they coddle them and they protect them against any legal threats or anything they do because they have a vested interest. That's the model that makes them money. Today, the business model for a Facebook or a Google, places where if you don't pay for the product, you are the product, right? So if in Facebook, you don't pay for it, but what they're doing is harvesting your information so they can monetize it and sell it to others. They, I think, have an appreciation of what it is, but that's their business model. And anything that gets in the way of that, any restrictions or limitations is bad for them because it makes it more difficult for them to scrape data and then to monetize it. So if it's disinformation or COVID scams or the January 6th uprising, I think they understand the negative implications of those, but it's contrary to their business model to really go after those in a significant way, because that's how they make their money.
So create for me, again, we're going to put it up on the screen, the book. How do we get this book, incidentally?
Thank you for asking. It's available online just about any place you can go to, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, indie book stores, really available. It's a quick search and you'll find it.
And again, I loved it. I wrote an Amazon review obviously because I loved it. What I'd like to do right now is flip things around. And if you were to write a sequel about how we prevented a world where there is the auction, what might that world realistically look like? How do we stop this from happening?
That's a great question and a tricky question for me, because I actually have a book 2 and 3 that continues to explore these issues.
Oh, great. And look forward to it.
Without giving away too much, it doesn't get prevented, really. So okay. It's a little bit tricky for me to think of the other book that doesn't do it. But in the auction, ultimately, there's an uprising among the Series Ds, the lower caste, whose lives are in danger in both direct ways and indirect ways. And they rise up, and that's the challenge Sasha faces, because she's stuck between these two competing interests, one of which is her father. And she has to grapple and find a middle ground in there, find her voice. So in a way, people who are disadvantaged by a system are going to rise up. There's always a action and reaction to everything. And we're seeing that right now today in our life. We've actually been seeing it for many years. We live in a time of tremendous disruption, whether it's technological, economic, social, and we're seeing the reaction to those things. And we're just in an intense period, because usually that type of technological, economic, and social changes, transformation, don't occur all exactly at the same time. But that's where we're at right now. And I think you can just look at history and see when those things happen, society has a lot of unrest and a lot of unease, because it creates concern about the future. So to answer your question, and I will, just a long answer, is I think it really comes down to people whose economic interest if there were an auction, to rise up and say, this doesn't work for me, because fundamentally, isn't that what our country's based on? Thomas Jefferson saying a little revolution is a good thing now and then?
Hearing it a lot these days, that Jefferson quote. You have anything to add?
Yeah, I do. I mean, this is an incredibly realistic and wise approach. It's not just like this, you know, Orwellian. There's a marriage of the present into the future. I think you're spot on with your 22-year-old concept, because I mean, today there's the mining of children's data in the public and private education sphere, and that kind of like lends itself to this 2050 novel. But I'm seeing an emerging trend where, you know, you could see this with the food movement, where people are buying local, shopping at farmers markets. They're essentially checking out of the system. And I think I'm starting to see some of that too with these, you know, the FANG giants, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, and Amazon. In your observation of the current landscape, do you see the potential anytime soon for investors to jump on that counter trend? To, you know, as you know, basically, what's the response to this concentrated power?
It's a great question. I think there's potential for that, but it has to be done in a way that's rational. Nothing occurs just simply because people want it. Look at climate change. If you're just telling people this is going to be difficult and it's not going to be good for you, but you should do it anyway, you're never going to get critical mass for it. It's got to be in their interests. So in the auction, it's in the interests of the system to exploit young people like this, and essentially to mortgage their future for their own gain. We're seeing that in real life now. In some instances, young people can actually mortgage, give away part of their future earnings to have a company pay for their college. That's a rational act by a college student to react to the fact that college has become prohibitive in costs. It's a destructive act because you're selling part of you're giving away some of your feed corn for now, but it's a rational act. So Jeremy, your question is, I do, but we have to actually have a system where it's a rational behavior for people to do that. We need rational rational behavior that leads to constructive outcomes, not rational behavior that leads to destructive outcomes. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Absolutely.
Wow. Thanks for spending so much time with us, Tom. Again, we're putting the book up on the screen. We're reminding people that it is for sale, and we have holidays coming up. Makes for a great and thoughtful gift. Journalist, communications expert, author of now what will be a series of novels, Tom Galvin, thanks for joining us on the Zogby Report.
I really appreciate it. I hope you guys have a great day.
Yeah, thanks.
Take care.
Take care.